At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
We take a look at how folks are feeling, what the deal is with going back to the office, and what does it mean to be single in this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Rima Khreis, in for Kai Rizdal. It is Wednesday, December 22nd. Good to have you with us. So, how are you feeling about the economy? Feeling good? Feeling okay? Because according to our latest consumer sentiment survey, despite having a lot of things to feel worried about, like, news of this highly contagious variant and rising inflation rates, consumers, people like me and you, don't appear to be all that shaken. The latest consumer sentiment numbers are out today from the Conference Board, which, you know, as we say a lot on this program, is an important thing to track. And this month, consumer confidence even ticked up a bit. Marketplace's Amanda Peacher gets us going.
What's surprising to John Lear of Morning Consult is just how little consumers seem to be fazed by Omicron.
Consumer confidence is actually up.
And Lear says with each COVID wave or new variant, consumer confidence is less reactive. And he says the vaccines factor in.
Vaccinations have been tremendously helpful in driving consumer confidence.
And he says consumers' outlook is boosted by the fact that businesses remain open even as cases rise.
This broader movement of growing resilience.
That's true for software engineer Adam Onden in Seattle. These days, he's not as freaked out by COVID news like he once was.
Now it feels manageable. It feels like COVID protocols are now just sort of part of our day-to-day life.
In other words, he'll mask up and take Omicron precautions, but those actions feel more like an extra step.
Like, oh, we're going to go drive up in the mountains. Make sure you've got your chains in your car and all your cold weather gear.
Still, even if consumer confidence rose this month, Sharon O'Halloran, political economy professor at Columbia, says uncertainty still lingers.
We still have significant inflation that is taking place. We still have significant supply chain disruptions. We have gas and food costs at significantly high levels.
And that's why O'Halloran says consumer confidence is still nowhere near as high as it was right before the pandemic. I'm Amanda Peacher for Marketplace.
So yesterday, just as a sort of extra precaution, with all the news of the Omicron variant spreading so quickly, I thought I'd buy a couple at-home COVID test kits. So I hit up three different stores and still came home empty-handed. Obviously, I'm just a sample size of one, but a lot of reports show that Americans are struggling to access COVID tests quickly and cheaply. Pharmacies have started to ration their kits. And across the country, mostly in big cities, you can see these long lines at testing sites wrap around the streets. Marketplace's Lily Jamali takes a look at the difficulties that come from relying on the private industry during a public health crisis.
Early in the pandemic, the federal government went big on supporting companies developing vaccines, but on testing, not so much. Lindsay Dawson is an associate director at the Kaiser Family Foundation. She says those priorities created uncertainty for makers of those COVID tests.
Companies were concerned that they didn't have a market. And in many senses, this is a natural response from a private company with a fiduciary and not public health responsibility.
That uncertainty came to a head this spring after people started getting vaccines, but before the Delta variant came along. Dr. Bob Wachter is chair of the Department of Medicine at UC San Francisco. He says that prompted the CDC to discourage vaccinated Americans from getting tested, even if they had COVID symptoms.
They believe that if you are fully vaccinated, you are not capable of transmitting the virus.
Demand for tests tanked. Some manufacturers even cut back production. But when the Delta variant emerged, the CDC reversed itself, and some firms started to ramp up their operations again. Wachter says in moments like this, it's essential for the private and public sectors to work together.
It really has to be a partnership, and I think it worked extraordinarily well with vaccines.
And many economists say getting testing right is key to sustaining an economic recovery and safeguarding the progress made so far. I'm Lily Jamali for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, despite worries about Omicron, traders were optimistic. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We talked about inflation at the top of the show with Amanda, which the Biden administration says it's trying to do something about, trying to smooth supply chain bottlenecks and bring down prices. For example, the administration has pushed ports to work 24/7. It fined ocean carriers for leaving cargo out on docks for too long, and it'll offer $230 million in port infrastructure development grants. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore took a look at how all of that is going so far.
So about those 24/7 port operations.
The ports are not operating 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Weston Labar is head of strategy for Cargomatic, a digital trucking broker. He says only a few port terminals have looked at the idea, and they aren't there yet. 24-hour ports, of course, need 24-hour trucks, and that's not happening either.
When you look at hours of service and you look at all of the federal restrictions as it relates to when drivers can drive and their reset hours, it's really hard to dedicate resources to something that may or may not happen.
Empty shipping containers have piled up, clogging ports and delaying truck traffic.
I think a lot more needs to be done going into 2022.
Jonathan Gold is with the National Retail Federation. Ultimately, ports are just one link in a long chain. From towns in the U.S. that don't want another truck depot in their city limits, on over to factories in Vietnam closed due to COVID surges. And lurking behind all of it, Gold says, the pandemic still has us spending our money on physical stuff.
The disruptions we see, part of it is because of the ongoing, significantly increased consumer demand that I think many expect to continue well into 2022.
And what's all this mean for inflation? Well, here's Kent Smetters with the Penn Wharton budget model.
Even if ports have opened up a bit more, we're still going to see an inflation rate next year, probably around 4%.
On the bright side, that's down from 6.8% annual inflation measured in November. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Around this time, there are plenty of articles and shows and movies all about being single during the holidays. You know, how to deal with nosy relatives, or maybe a movie about a tenacious protagonist committed to doing the holidays solo. Whatever the case, and however you feel about it, the fact is, more Americans are single today than ever before. About 28% of adults live alone, compared to about 13% back in 1960. But as Anne Helen Peterson writes in Vox, even though the numbers are going up, a lot of our economic system isn't keeping up with the social changes, because everything from the tax code to Social Security is kind of built on the foundation that Americans will get married. Anne Helen Peterson, welcome to the program.
Hi, I'm so happy to be here.
So you write that even though there are more Americans who are single today, there is an underlying hostility towards them. Big picture, what do you mean by that?
So the way I'm thinking about hostility is less about like someone yelling at you about being single and more about like when we talk about a hostile climate environment. So like the Arctic, right? Or the desert. Mm-hmm. In those environments, it is hostile for life to thrive, right? Mm-hmm. There have to be significant adaptations in order for whatever life that does live there to survive. And most things do not survive.
Right.
That is kind of how I think about what it takes to be single in the United States.
I see. And can you just give more examples of why single life can be so expensive?
Any single person will be able to rattle these things out to you. Some of it is just the cost of paying for every single thing for your house mm-hmm. on your own, right? Like you need to buy a new vacuum. That is your cost burden and yours alone. Mm-hmm. But it's also a time tax. And what I mean by that is that anytime something needs to be done in your home, you know, that is borne by you alone. And if time is money, like that's a very utilitarian way of thinking about mm-hmm. this, but single people pay more of that tax. I think sometimes people are like, well, that's your decision, right? You get all the freedoms of being single, and that is the price that you pay. But yeah. I think we also have a paucity of imagination when it comes to thinking of different ways that we can arrange life. Things like the social safety net, things like the way we organize health insurance, the way that we think about retirement so that it doesn't penalize single people.
Right. There was one stat that you mentioned in your article that just blew my mind. It was that an unmarried woman making around $40,000, and this is back in 2010, could stand to pay almost $500,000 more over her lifetime than a married woman. Which is wild. Like, what?
Right? So this was a scenario that was run by two authors who were writing for The Atlantic. And they put together all of the accumulated costs and also just the ways in which people who are single, like the amount of taxes that they pay and also the way that their Social Security benefit works, and taking into account the persistent wage gap as well. Mm-hmm. And that number was that overall calculation, which seems so striking, right? Like if you said to someone, okay, here are the two choices in your life. You can pay this many million dollars more to be single, or you can be married. I mean, essentially, that is the decision that we put forth to people. We just don't put it in such stark terms.
Right. And so are you hopeful that things will change, that policy might at some point in the near future become less centered around the assumption that we're married?
I mean, here's the thing.
Yeah.
There are things in this country that are incredibly popular that we still cannot push through to become policy. I think that a lot of people, a lot of white conservative people in particular, still believe that the best thing for everyone is if everyone is married and has children and lives in a home of their own.
Yeah.
But that's not a sustainable way forward, right? Nearly 40% of the population is either single or a single parent. And the ways in which people are falling through these social safety nets evidences that we need this sort of change. So my hope is that we can push for more imagination for how to create these systems of care for one another.
And Helen Peterson writes the newsletter Culture Study, also in Vox, about the cost of being single. And thanks for coming on.
My total pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up,
we'll gift each of you $10,000 in cash.
I mean, I'll take that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones gained 261 points, 0.7%, to finish at 35,753. The NASDAQ went up 180 points, 0.1%, to end at 15,521. The S&P 500 rose 47 points, 1%, to land at 4,696. We heard from Sabri that the Biden administration is calling attention to some good news about the supply chain. In shipping stock news, Star Bulk Carriers rose 2.4%. Nordic American Tankers gained 0.5%. Planning on traveling this week? 1,979,089 people passed through TSA checkpoints yesterday. That's only a couple of thousand fewer people than on the same date in 2019. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.45%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Rima Khreis. There have been moments these last couple of years where it feels like we're almost stuck in this weird, twisted game of deja vu. At least, that's definitely how it's felt with back-to-office plans. One minute, companies are telling employees, all right, come back to the office. And then the next minute, they're like, wait, just kidding. COVID cases are bad. We're going to push it back again. Understandably, a lot of workplaces still have no idea when or if they're going to bring back employees. But with all that uncertainty comes opportunity. Matthew Boyle is a workplace reporter for Bloomberg who told me the other day about the rise of the return to office consulting industry.
There's sort of this cottage industry growing of advice and guidance from everyone from, you know, the sort of blue chip management consultants over at McKinsey and Bain to consultants who specialize in HR and the workforce like Mercer, but even just sort of, you know, random etiquette experts, you know, people who are experts in filtration and airflow. And you had all these people putting shingles out and saying, hey, trust me, I can lead you through your return to office. And I said, well, can you? Because no one's ever done this before. So what do we really know?
Right. It's like everyone's smelling the opportunity and suddenly everyone is a futurist.
Yeah, exactly.
You wrote that if you you just go on LinkedIn, you can find like, what, 17,000 online courses on how to return to the office?
Well, no, there's about 17,000 courses in total. But there are I discovered that there are tons of courses around how to return to the office. And some of them are taught by like, you know, experts in holistic nutrition, and some of them are taught by, you know, construction guys who know exactly what to do about, you know, your HVAC system. And I just said, wow, so people and there people are clicking on them, and you know, some of them are, you know, some of them are pretty helpful. I mean, because there is some valid questions like when you go back to the office, are you shaking hands? How do you deal with the coworkers? Yeah. You know, what do you do with the water cooler? So some of them are very valid questions, and it just kind of speaks to the fact that there's this void of any real actual expertise, but companies are spending millions, sometimes tens of millions for advice because, of course, corporate America has never done this before.
Mm-hmm. So given how quickly the need for these consultants came about, do you feel like there are people with actual expertise to meet the demand?
Well, the thing is, yeah, I mean, now that we've been doing this for almost 2 years, I think there certainly are people who have a decent sense of like, okay, you have to, the first thing you have to do is just, you have to take a look, a close look at your workforce and segmented it out to figure out, okay, you know, who can be fully remote forever. But once you do that, and that's all well and good, then you might get a little resentment from the people who are like, oh, wait a minute, Bob can be fully remote forever and I got to go in Tuesday through Thursday. Why can't I have Bob's job? Or why am I at this company to begin with? So even when you get a little bit of more knowledge and a little bit more sense of, okay, this is how we're going to go forward, then you run the risk of, you know, worker resentment and people just saying, well, you know, I'll just go down the street to a company where I can be fully remote forever.
Mm-hmm. You cited one survey in your article that said more than half of workers would consider quitting if they're asked to go back to the office before they're ready, which is wild.
Yeah. And the reasons are pretty, you know, kind of obvious. One of the few clear things now is that people are used to working from home. They have a pretty nice setup. You know, I'm standing here at a nice standing desk.
Are you wearing sweatpants?
You know, I'm wearing, well, let's just call them upscale sweatpants.
Yeah,
you know, I've upgraded my look, certainly. But yes, I'm in very casual clothes that I would not have worn to an office ever in 2019. And so, you know, and companies are now saying, well, now you must be back 3 days a week. That's our RTO plan. And people are saying, well, why three? Why can't I come back two? Or, you know, I still haven't found daycare yet, or my daycare, you know, is having trouble staffing up. And it's just this sense of, you know, I'm perfectly productive at home. Why are you forcing me into a new arrangement at some downtown office that doesn't need to be the center of work anymore?
Right. Man, hearing you say all this, it's like, oh, it does make sense why there's this crop of consultants that have, you know, sprouted up. During the pandemic.
They're always around. Yeah, I mean, no matter the issue, you know, and what they're doing now is this sort of what they call transformation services. So rather than just coming in and helping a company with, like, you know, a big layoff or a merger, coming in for 6 weeks and then leaving, transformation services, you know, it's kind of like seeing your therapist. You know, it never, ever ends. You know, there's always something else we can do. You could always have another step on this journey of transformation. So they might not be calling it RTO work. It might just sort of get subsumed into the broader, you know, workforce transformation, or what we're now calling, you know, future of work engagements. And there's another wonderful buzzword, because, you know, the future of, if you're working on the future of work, you're never going to be out of work.
And that means you're forever going to be on this beat.
I don't mind, as long as I'm gainfully employed. Yes.
No, it's a great beat. It's a great one. Matthew Boyle is a senior reporter at Bloomberg Businessweek. Matthew, thank you so much for coming onto the show.
Thanks for having me.
Imagine for a minute that you're a student. Maybe you already are. Now, imagine waking up one morning, checking your tuition balance, fully expecting to see a scary, huge number, but instead, it's a big, fat zero. That's what happened to thousands of students across the country. Historically, Black colleges and universities got a bunch of stimulus money, about $1 billion, and some of the schools have been funneling that money directly to students, wiping out their loans and getting rid of past due fees. Which, for students, that can already feel pretty unbelievable. But one school in Tennessee thought, all right, we got all this money, we've got a lot of students who need it, why not take things a step further? Blake Farmer of WPLN in Nashville has more.
Just before students at Meharry Medical College went home for Thanksgiving, President James Hildreth sent them a video message that felt a little hard to believe.
We'll gift each of you $10,000 in cash. You heard me right.
Dr. Hildreth explained that this money was from the CARES Act, and that after deep consideration, the administration decided to give it directly to future doctors, dentists, and public health researchers, nearly 1,000 students in all. In part, it's recognition for how those students helped in the pandemic response, staffing Nashville's COVID testing and vaccination sites. Meharry also graduates more Black physicians than almost any other U.S. school, and half of its MDs go into the high demand but lower paying field of primary care.
We felt that there was no better way to begin distributing these funds than by giving to our students, who will soon give so much to our world.
Cheers erupted in the library as students received the video link. Andreas Nelson says he fell silent, staring at his banking app in disbelief.
$10,000 was sitting just in my bank account, and it was a start. Like, I was just literally lost for words.
I talked to Nelson as students were zipping across campus to take finals. The Chicago native is finishing a master's degree in health science with hopes of entering the dental school. It's a program where the average student loans total more than $280,000. So the 10 grand wouldn't make much of a dent. Nelson says it feels as though he's being treated like an adult, receiving money with no strings attached.
It's motivating because that means they have trust in us to do with this money for whatever the cause may be, whether it be student debt, investing, or just personal, you know, enjoyment.
Nelson says a good chunk of his check will go towards rent, though he also hopes to make some investments. Across the board, students at HBCUs rely more on student loans than their peers at other schools, partly because the institutions have less money for scholarships and partly because the students' families have less wealth to tap into. Meharry's average student debt is far higher than Vanderbilt's School of Medicine across town. Rodriguez Murray helps HBCUs lobby for higher education funding. More than 20 have used CARES Act money to erase outstanding tuition balances. Some have canceled student fees. He says Meharry is the rare case of putting money directly in the pockets of students.
So these young people are rising to medical school against all odds. And of course they have to borrow more because people that look like them have less.
Meharry has taken other steps in the last year to support students financially, including paying for expensive test prep services. Acing a benchmark exam is key to finishing on time, and Meharry's completion rate is well below average. Murray notes that, on average, Black household wealth is just $17,000, 10 times less than the average white household.
The fact that these students are largely coming from lower socioeconomic backgrounds means that the funds that Meharry turned around and gave to the students are particularly impactful.
For some, Murray says, $10,000 to spend any way they need may make all the difference in whether they cross the finish line and become a doctor who can afford all the debt they've taken on. In Nashville, I'm Blake Farmer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out. Last year on New Year's Eve, when the clock struck midnight, heaps of confetti fell onto Times Square. But not gonna lie, looked kind of sad. The city understandably kept the crowds super small because of COVID. This year, though, the party was supposed to be back on. The plan was to require everyone to be fully vaccinated. But now New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio is thinking that they should enforce more restrictions. New York City is not doing great right now, with COVID cases hitting new records. De Blasio says they'll make a final decision before Christmas. Meanwhile, you'll find me on a couch with some blankets, maybe with some hot cocoa, watching the ball drop on TV. All right, we've got to go, but not before our moment of economic context. We just heard a story about students getting some debt relief, and today President Biden announced that he is extending the moratorium on federal student loan payments. For a while there, the White House insisted it would not extend the pause on those payments beyond the January 31st deadline. But now, with this new variant spreading so rapidly, students can put off payments until May 1st. According to the Federal Reserve, Americans owe more than $1.7 trillion in student loans. That's a lot of money. But for some context, a decade ago, that number was closer to $900 billion. Our media production team includes Brian Allison, Drew Jostad, Gary O'Keefe, Jeff Peters, Liana Squalacci, Charlton Thorpe, Juan Carlos Torrado, and Becca Weinman. I'm Rima Jerez, and we'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.